Open Source is sponsored by listeners like you. Pitch in to keep the world's first podcast going strong. 15 years and counting. Find us at patreon.com/radioopensource. And thank you. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. The trouble in the land has roots in two centuries and more of slavery, we know, but also in the way slavery ended in a horrible civil war and then a failed attempt to reimagine and rebuild a nation of free and equal people. That restart, less familiar in my old textbooks, was called Reconstruction. It got pushed aside after a decade for what was called redemption, meaning restoration of white planter power and forced Jim Crow subjection of the former slaves. This is our unfinished history. As in James Joyce's most famous line, history as the nightmare from which we are still trying to awake. In the turmoil around the headline viruses, COVID-19 and racism, we have a sort of thought experiment this hour. Is yet another reconstruction what we really need? Can we picture it? The law teacher, Kimberly Crenshaw, is going to walk us along real and made-up roads toward a new nation. But first, the acclaimed historian of the Civil War and its aftermath, Eric Foner at Columbia University, is reintroducing us to Reconstruction and its relevance.
History doesn't repeat itself exactly, but there are parallels, and I think we can learn something from the Reconstruction era and the progress and the retrenchment, and maybe understand why so many people today are so angry about the current status of this country that they are, you know, taking themselves into the streets. As Martin Luther King said, you know, riot is the language of the unheard. When people are really feel that no one is listening, this is often the method they take to gain attention.
Eric Foner, the tragedy that brings us to this point was 1877, the abandonment of Reconstruction. Go back to the beginning, the end of the Civil War, and the idea of Reconstruction. Whose idea was it, and what were the essentials?
The idea of Reconstruction was sort of inevitable. Once slavery was destroyed in the Civil War, Reconstruction meant creating a new society in the South. Slavery was the fundamental institution of Southern life. It was a system of labor, a system of politics, a system of race relations, a system of wealth. With slavery gone, all those things had to be remade, redone, reconstructed. Now, there were many people who thought, no, we don't really need much change. All right, slavery's gone. We understand that. But black people should just go back to work on the plantations. They're not really entitled to civil rights, political rights. They're free. That's enough. One of the leading proponents of that idea was Andrew Johnson. The vice president became president when Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. He was a strong white supremacist. He used language that is not all that different from some of the things we hear coming out of the White House nowadays of white nationalism. But he was opposed and defeated, at least initially, by the Republican Party in Congress, led by the radical Republicans, Charles Sumner, Thaddeus Stevens, and others. Backed up by the activism of the 4 million former slaves who were demanding their rights. And they said, we're not going, quote, back to normal or anything near normal. This is the time to remake this society on the basis of equality. And so they rewrote the Constitution, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, abolished slavery, introduced the concept of equality for all Americans, and gave black men the right to vote. They've created new governments in the South with blacks and whites holding office, voting the first time we had interracial democracy. You know, it was a remarkable experiment. Unfortunately, it also generated a very big violent backlash, which gained force in the 1870s. And many Northerners began to weary of the fight over slavery and its legacy. As you mentioned, 1877, that's often seen as the end of Reconstruction, by which time all the Southern states were back in the hands of white supremacist Democrats. But then things went on. I mean, in the sense that the Supreme Court played a major role in the late 19th century in basically undermining the purposes of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, interpreting them in the most narrow possible way, and allowing the South, the white South, to basically rescind many of the rights that had been achieved by African Americans during Reconstruction.
You're known as an enthusiast about Reconstruction itself, its accomplishment in social life, influences on church life, on home life, on education. All of them fascinating news and experiments. What went wrong?
You know, look, anything created by human beings is going to be flawed in some way. There were problems in Reconstruction. There was corruption in some of these state governments. It really, progress was the major thing you mentioned. It was first establishment of public school systems in the South for white as well as black pupils. You know, that was a tremendous change in Southern life. The election of these African-Americans to public office. What went wrong? As I said, this violent reaction, we know about terrorism from abroad, but this was the time of homegrown American terrorism, the Ku Klux Klan and groups like that, which systematically assassinated local leaders and intimidated African-Americans, try to make them not go to vote. You know, there was a failure, so to speak, to enforce the law, especially as time went on. At the beginning, President Grant, when he came in after 1868, he did send federal troops into South Carolina in the early 1870s and crushed the Ku Klux Klan. But unfortunately, the will to do that waned as the 1870s went on. And as violence continued in many places, the North sort of washed its hands of Reconstruction, or many did. The will to enforce the law, the will to enforce equality. You know, the argument that you heard then and you hear now is, no, this is all reverse discrimination. Blacks are getting everything and white people are having their rights taken away, you know, as if expanding rights for non-whites somehow takes something away from white people. That rhetoric was very common by the opponents of Reconstruction, what we call today reverse discrimination. So it's a complicated story, but the basic ending of it is that by 1900, African-Americans in the South were back into a position, not of slavery, but of very few rights, the rights they had gained, taken away, abrogated. And it took a long, long time into the 1960s for the agenda of Reconstruction to be reinvigorated.
And the plantocracy was back in charge.
The plantocracy was still there. Now, you know, there was some industrialization in the South. There were merchants gaining control of much of the economy. But the South was actually a kind of a site of dire poverty for most of this period. In the 1930s, FDR said the South is our number one economic problem. And blacks were sort of at the bottom of the ladder in the poorest region in the country.
Eric Foner, speak of Reconstruction as an experiment from which we have to learn anew, and maybe a different sort of Reconstruction, but a clean break with not only slavery, but the slavery regime, with some sort of constitutional rejection of human subordination, and then enforcement of rights, and maybe re-education of all of us.
It is remarkable. Reconstruction was a remarkable effort in that it's just a few years after the end of the most important slave regime in world history, at least since the Roman Empire, you know. And yet 3 or 4 years after the end of that system, you have African Americans achieving equal rights in the society, at least in constitutional legal terms, and holding significant positions of power in the old slave area. What can we learn? I mean, you know, to me, what we can learn is, first of all, these principles are still out there. The 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments have never been repealed. They're still in the Constitution. The idea that citizens ought to enjoy equality is in the 14th Amendment, even though, as we have seen, the law is not enforced equally in this country very frequently, to say the least. The right to vote in the Constitution, and yet being challenged all over the place today. Many states are trying to suppress the right to vote, throwing people off the voting rolls for, you know, trivial or no reason whatsoever. In other words, these issues are still contested 150 years later. The idea of black being equal citizens in the United States is contested. The idea that every citizen ought to have the right to vote is contested.
I mean, we know that there was a whole romantic history of the lost cause of the wonderful slave society, which did rule public education almost into modern times. But why is that? Why is it that the victory, the military victory, did not become an effective social on-the-ground people's victory?
It's hard, as I said before, to just overturn centuries of opinions, assumptions, prejudices, whatever you want to call them. Every slave system generated a deep racial hierarchy. and an ideology of racial superiority and inequality. And in the United States, racism was very deeply entrenched and existed even among, you know, some of the people who were trying to bring about Reconstruction. And it's hard to get rid of that. Now, there were people who said, you know, what we really need is just military occupation of the South for a generation. Let them learn a new way of living. And let us just make sure that violence can be suppressed. But, you know, that's not really comfortable in a democratic country. You want to have a civilian government, not military government.
Sure.
So that didn't really happen. And the governments that were created were too weak to survive in many cases. And as I said, the national retreat, which takes place slowly over time, it's not just one moment. It takes place in the 1870s, the 80s, the 1890s. And I have to say it, historians are part of this and giving a legitimation to it. You mentioned the sort of romance of the lost cause. There was also an opposite, the non-romance of Reconstruction, that, you know, historians taught this was a terrible mistake. We should never have given African-Americans these rights. Black people are just not capable of exercising democratic rights in our society. And so the white South is justified in abrogating those rights. And as I say, for decades, historians were simply writing books that legitimated the Jim Crow system in the South and the denial of basic rights of citizenship to African-Americans.
We're trying to imagine this radio hour, a sort of second Reconstruction. But a lot of very sound people would say, no, we had it in the Civil Rights Movement.
The Civil Rights Movement was called the Second Reconstruction by many people. And it was the second time that there was a mass movement and governmental action to try to secure the basic rights of African-American people. Yeah, people today think we need a third Reconstruction. But, you know, as we said, history doesn't repeat itself exactly. What we need today is a Reconstruction that will affect everybody, that will confront head on the deep inequalities that have been entrenched in this society. There is the racial inequality, which is deep, but there are other kinds of inequality, as we are seeing. We need a Reconstruction to address that.
Eric Foner has won all the big prizes for a long shelf of history books. You could start with his Pulitzer winner, The Fiery Trial, Abraham Lincoln, and American Slavery. Coming up, how to build on history that you cannot embrace or change. This is Open Source. The promise of Reconstruction in the 1870s gave way to a devastating backlash that's been with us in waves ever since. Our guest, Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, points us forward, warily. She teaches the law of rights at Columbia and UCLA. She's a lifelong activist, best known for the idea of intersectionality in the zone where freedom issues overlap, touching race, sex, gender, and human rights. It matters that she had a consultant's hand in drafting South Africa's post-apartheid constitution in the 1990s. My opening question with her is, what in the world could rescue us from our racial past but a new Reconstruction?
I start with an exercise in my civil rights class all the time. And, you know, the first proposition is we should stop celebrating July the 4th because, you know, July the 4th is the embodiment of a republic that was predicated on the deprivation of rights of people of African descent. And many times when I asked the students to perform what that conversation would sound like, they would say, oh, we can't reject our history. We can't reject our birthright. We are a free people. And yes, it was imperfect, but we're coming around to it. Then I'd say, okay, so if we must embrace all of our history, then let's talk about reparations. Let's talk about holding up that history that we want to hold as our own and correct for those things that are deeply structured into our society. And then people say, oh, that's not our history. We weren't here at the time. None of us owned any slaves. That's not part of who we are. We've got to say, part of what makes us think we are the greatest thing ever is part of what is our continuing legacy. We built this country off of the lack of freedom of some of us.
Kimberly Crenshaw, I want you to be as specific as you can about essential things that would have to go into this process?
Well, I think most importantly, we have to have a constitutional understanding that's built on a freedom baseline as opposed to a slave baseline. There was a time that if someone who was enslaved wanted to free themselves, they managed to do that. They managed to escape. If they were taken back, the crime that they were charged with was theft. They were charged with stealing themselves, right? How is it that self-helping your way into freedom is seen as theft? It's against a constitutional baseline that began the entire game with the idea that some people would be owned and some people would owe their labor to someone else, right? A baseline of freedom would mean every time someone escaped, they were helping themselves to their freedom. They were self-actualizing what we think we all have a right to. There would be no crime. There would be no effort to punish. They would be doing what they're supposed to do. Now, the million-dollar question was, did that baseline from slavery that framed freedom as theft ever change? The end of Reconstruction suggested that that baseline never did change. All the things that were done to enhance the liberty of the freedmen were repudiated by a Supreme Court that basically said those things were preferential treatment. The first President Johnson vetoed all of these freedom-enhancing kind of laws, saying that it discriminated against white people, right? So we look at that now and we think, what were they thinking? How could less than 20 years after the end of slavery, the Supreme Court strike down a civil rights law that was only meant to provide black people with the same rights to sit in a theater or sit in a restaurant or ride on a train that white people had? How could that be repudiated as preferential treatment?
What's the living legacy, if there is one, of that liberty as theft in our world today, do you think?
I think we're seeing it everywhere. So when we have debates over whether black people have a right to complain about the fact that still more than 50 years after the collapse of formal inequality, we are underrepresented in every institution that is a positive one. We're underrepresented as teachers and professors and doctors and lawyers and scientists. We are underrepresented in neighborhoods that actually are places that sustain people rather than tear them down. We are overrepresented right now in COVID cases. So to ask for, to demand the kinds of policies that would remedy that would correct for those things, that would go through the structures and see where these disparate distributions take place, when we ask for these things, when even politicians make them possible, they are repudiated as preferential treatment. They are basically framed as theft. Literally, it happens when parents in underfunded school districts attempt to send their children to better funded school districts, perhaps using their parents' address or an uncle's address. They're actually charged with theft. That's literally the same thing as the past. But more broadly, figuratively, to ask for, to expect redistributions of opportunity, rethinking how we go about deciding who's qualified to be a police officer, who should get a chance to be a lawyer. Those kinds of demands that we look to the way that race has played a role in maldistribution, that's framed as preferential treatment. Reverse discrimination, taking away from white people to give to black people. So the baselines have not changed, and consequently, efforts to actually create more equality are seen as giving people something they don't deserve. That would have to change.
What would the basic strokes be in constitutional reform or legislation to start this process?
The first stroke in constitutional reform is to move away and fully repudiate the idea that equality is satisfied by colorblindness.
Hmm.
That is huge. What the court has managed to do with this ideology of colorblindness is basically the same thing as the great philosopher Anatole France once says. The law in its majestic equality
yes.
prohibits the rich and the poor from sleeping under bridges.
Right.
That's supposed to be equal. Why is that unequal? Well, obviously, it doesn't take into account that the rich and the poor are not similarly situated, never have been similarly situated. So treating them as though they are is creating an inequality. But our contemporary civil rights law, our contemporary equal protection law does not acknowledge that. It embraces the idea that Anatole France is trying to critique in that moment. That's number one. That's first and foremost. But the other thing is this. We have a court that says that there is a moral equivalence. Clarence Thomas wrote this. There's a moral equivalence between using race as a means of excluding and subordinating people, which is what segregation was.
Right.
And the use of race as a welcome mat, right? The use of race to bring people in, the use of race to broaden the door, to rearrange the furniture, to do things differently than the way we did it when we actually embraced segregation. The court says these two things are absolutely the same. When Linda Brown sued, saying that her exclusion from a school for white students was discriminatory. It was a violation of the 14th Amendment. What the court is now saying is that she was discriminated in going to her black school in the same way that white students were in going to a white school. That it's the same thing. But we know it's not the same thing. We know discrimination on the basis of race was not simply an injury of classification. It was an injury of second-class citizenship. It was an extension of the idea that was introduced by and affirmed by the Supreme Court that effectively said black people have no rights that white people are bound to respect. That's a particular racial harm against a particular group. And the extent to which the Supreme Court has moved away from that has been the extent to which the law cannot do the work it needs to do in reconstituting a third Reconstruction. They can't dismantle the history and legacy of racism and white supremacy, because to actually acknowledge that legacy is to create a racial harm, according to the Supreme Court.
What is that?
Yeah, sorry, that is our curfew.
Whose curfew?
Los Angeles's curfew.
Wow, that's serious. The objective is to make an American society on the basis of equality. Can it be done, and how?
If we were to bring forward the idea that we have to uproot the whole idea of slavery today, we would build on uprooting the contemporary consequences of slavery, uprooting the contemporary consequences of segregation. So what does that mean? It means that we cannot look around and see who lives where, who works where, who has what and who doesn't as simply the natural consequence of people's talent and willingness to work hard.
Okay.
That's not what we have now. What we have is the spoils of slavery and the spoils of segregation. Those spoils are the product of specific laws that were put in place that gave white people things that it denied to black people. And some part of that is framed as freedom, but some of it is real particular. So let's look at what happened at the end of World War II, when our government spent $120 billion creating the suburbs.
Yes.
And they created these suburbs in racial terms. They allowed for these suburbs to be populated on the basis of race. So it meant that a returning GI who was black and a returning GI who was white, who both had $45 a month to spend on housing, had completely different trajectories, and their families now have completely different trajectories. What does that mean? The white GI was able to go to Levittown, for example.
right.
And to buy a two-bedroom house, to live a suburban life, and to create equity in that home and use that equity to educate his children and to take care of his parents in old age and to pass that equity on so that he would be taken care of at old age. Same $45. The Black family, not allowed to move to Levittown, not allowed to actually purchase the American dream, is stuck in high-rise apartment buildings for the same $45 a month, does not develop equity, is not able to save for old age, is not able to send his children to school, is not now worth over $100,000 more than what the white person is worth, starting off with exactly the same amount of money. Now, people will say that was a long time ago. What does that have to do with now? I would say if you have equity in your home, your equity today is built on what you were able to invest in it a long time ago. So discrimination that happens 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago doesn't become less significant as time passes. It becomes more significant.
Of course, compound interest, so to speak.
Exactly. And whiteness is a compounded interested concept, and Blackness is a compounded deficit. We can't get at it through a colorblind regime. So what that means is when we look around and see what are the consequences of this compounded interest versus compounded deficit, we see those consequences in terms of education. We see those consequences in terms of where people live. We see it in terms of what jobs they have. And so when the efforts are made to dismantle this inequality and say we need affirmative action programs to create more opportunities for African Americans and other people of color to become lawyers, to become doctors, to have access to public employment, when those are on the table and they get repudiated as reverse discrimination, what that move does in this contemporary period is the same thing that the move did in 1883, when the Supreme Court struck down civil rights laws as taking something away from white people. It is the same thing playing out again and again and again.
Kimberly Crenshaw, I keep wondering, what are the strokes that have to be done? Minds, hearts, a lot of re-education, but also law.
Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has to be completely remade. The Supreme Court is the institution that makes possible the kind of policing that took the life of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. The Supreme Court is the institution that says that police officers can go into your home on no-knock warrants and terrorize you. Plain clothes. You don't even know that they're police. The Supreme Court is what makes that possible. So I would start there. But of course, there has to be a revolution in people's thinking about the normalcy, the way in which existing inequality is seen as just there. We saw this with COVID. The virus attached itself to the inequalities that were already existing in our society. The inequalities in terms of who had the capacity to shelter in place and who didn't. Less than 20% of Black workers had the capacity to do their jobs from home. We're opening up American society, and the infection rate hasn't changed, not one bit. What's changed is the recognition of which group is going to suffer the most. So if we're in the middle of this moment, when we're willing to wipe our hands and move on, knowing what part of our population is going to suffer the most, then obviously we are still dealing with a society that sees Black bodies in terms of what it can do for its comfort and its wealth.
We're back to Frederick Douglass.
Yeah.
There's no Black problem in America. There's a white problem.
Yeah.
Is that still the core of it? Living up to our own ideals, but even seeing, examining our own minds.
I saw a photo yesterday from, I think, one of the marches that really frightened me. There was a picture of a man, I guess he was a father, with two of his young kids standing there in riot gear with guns. These kids have been born since Barack Obama was president of the United States.
Wow.
They are being fed a diet that is 400 years old. It does not die. When Dylann Roof took the life of a woman who lived through all of this.
Right.
You know, a woman who lived.
We're talking
who
was Charleston, alive, South Carolina.
Yes. She was alive during the Tulsa riots, I think. Lived through the worst moments of white supremacy in the 20th century. To live to that ripe old age and to be killed by someone who was born after the civil rights movement. Mm. I see white supremacy like that horror movie with the character that never dies. You know, you think that they're actually, you know, destroyed at the end, like Friday the 13th Halloween.
No.
They keep coming back again and again and again. And that's even without a president that was encouraging them to rise back up. Now we have a president who bases his future on resurrecting Jim Crow. It's a horror, I would say. You know,
a virus, maybe.
And that's exactly what some people have been saying. It is a virus because it's not a stable one. It does recede, to be sure. But once it gets activated again, it gets activated across many different sectors. People touch each other with it. And suddenly ideas and resentments that were at one point seen as illegitimate are now in full effect right now. What is that other than a virus?
Coming up, Kimberly Crenshaw's case for an equality clause. This is Open Source. South Africa wrote a new constitution for itself almost 30 years ago on the fall of its white settler colonial apartheid regime. Our guest, Kimberly Crenshaw, had a role as a consultant observer that clarified for her and for the drafters a point that bears on American justice too. In short, that there is a multiplicity, a mesh of rights that can be violated one by one, but also protected together.
I was honored that my work was cited by the drafters in creating an equality clause in the Constitution.
Speak of it, because we don't have one in ours.
We have an equality clause. We
equal
don't have
rights.
An affirmative action clause. But they made it clear that the protection against discrimination was not based on one classification separately from another, like you protect against race or you're protected against gender, but you're protected against discrimination on race, gender, historical, tribal status, or any of these things in combination. And that was designed to ensure that South African women weren't placed in the same position as women of color here in the United States, often having to choose between their claims as people of color, as black women in particular, or their claims as women. Our jurisprudence made many women who were saying, I'm discriminated against as a black woman. This thing that's happening to me is not happening to black people who are men, and it's not happening to women who are white. It's happening to me as a black woman. Our courts had said, well, you can't make a claim of discrimination again then, because you can't claim race discrimination because, you know, blacks are being hired even though they're all men. And you can't claim gender discrimination because women are being hired even though they're all white. So that was a catch-22 that visited itself upon the aspirations of black women to find opportunities in institutions and in companies that had traditionally discriminated against them. So the lesson was picked up by many of the advocates who were participating in drafting the South African provision, and they made it clear that you can't just have these singular things. You have to understand that inequality actually happens along multiple avenues of discrimination, and the protection has to be as robust as the vulnerability is. So it was really eye-opening to observe how the spirit of creating a new society really was expressed through the Constitution making moment, it was also sobering to see that what's on paper doesn't always translate to practice. I mean, we've got some great rights here. Great rights. It's the practice. It's the cost. It's the politics that often make it difficult for those rights to be realized. So on that, we are very much siblings. We have a history that we want to repudiate, but we have resistance to fully realizing those rights.
South Africa had the benefit of a Truth and Reconciliation Commission. It took years, involved thousands of people. We haven't had it. But how has South Africa in general dealt with racial antagonism, racial envy, racial hatred? Is there anything for us to learn there constructively?
So I wish we had had our own truth and reconciliation process. And I know it was complicated. It was very complicated.
Could we do it still?
You know, I think it's something that can be and should be demanded. I think that it runs up against tremendous resistance, in part because we have generations of people who would need to be part of that demand, who really are of the belief that all these things happened a long time ago and they're not implicated in it at all. Of course, that's part of why we need it, because people are unaware of how the past still walks among us. But I do think that there are real benefits of being able to occupy space and tell stories that actually show how the ground we are standing on, the very architecture that we take as just being there, is built off of specific kinds of policies, specific moments in the past. Brian Stevenson, a good friend of mine for over 40 years, is doing precisely that in his memorialization of lynching, actually taking the ground from the sites of these horrific acts and making these memorials places where people have to deal with the materiality of what happened. We are ambivalent about our history. We want to celebrate those things that make us exceptional. And we want to repudiate the conditions of that possibility. The second most valuable form of property that this country was built on was property in human beings.
Yes.
How did that property get produced? What was the process in which human beings were produced? That was through the industrialization of the sexual abuse of Black women. When we talk about reproductive freedom, historically, we don't talk about the fact that Black women were actually bred to produce this property. And then the stereotypes about them that were generated to make this acceptable to polite society continued unabated. So when you see stereotypes about Black women still that make it difficult for Black women who are survivors of rape to actually be believed, to actually see their rapist prosecuted, to actually see them convicted, to actually see them serve time. When you see that and it is associated with stereotypes about Black women's sexuality, that goes all the way back to slavery. When you see Black women being framed as bad mothers, as not invested in their children, as only having children to get a welfare check, that goes all the way back to slavery. When to produce this population, you had to have a logic that allowed you to rip them from the arms of their mothers. What did you have to think about these mothers in order to do that, to build an entire economy on that? We have not grappled with the intersectional dimensions of white supremacy and patriarchy as they have shaped the lives of Black women. And that's still something that has yet to be taken up by anti-racists and by feminists.
Your man, Brian Stevenson, has done a remarkable teaching job. I was also impressed, if I got to say, recently, Andrew Cuomo was the one who, for me, surfaced that it's 30 years now since Rodney King, the photographing of police riots on the bodies of Black men up to George Floyd in Minneapolis. Why can't that be taught? And if an American politician of Andrew Cuomo's stripe and maybe ambition can embrace it, why can't we all learn that and see it?
Well, a few caveats. The first being that it is an important step to actually name Rodney King. It's an important step to actually name the many bodies that have lost their lives or have been beaten because the police basically are unconstrained, largely. It's another thing to actually change the systems so that that doesn't happen. Andrew Cuomo is great on one, not so great on the other.
Let's assume we have to change the performance of our police and our recognition of the people they're killing.
So what are the steps in having to change that? I would say there are hundreds of things, but I'll offer a few. I think, number one, we cannot reify the police. We can't say that your knee on someone's neck for over 8 minutes is magically transformed into a justifiable act of law enforcement because you have a blue shirt and a pair of black pants on while you're doing it. I mean, that's effectively how the police have been able to get away with the kinds of violence that they have inflicted upon black bodies. We give police unlimited authority simply because they carry something that somehow is invested with some, you know, magical cloaking device, right? This isn't what it looks like because they're police officers. Well, let's think about it. Police officers throughout history have been empowered to surveil, to discipline, to beat, and to take black life. Starting with paddy rollers who used to roll through plantations, extending all up to this very day. Why do we let them do it? We let them do it in part because they are able to convince us that they are the only thing that stands between us and the mob. And so they have to have this authority to basically take our lives without being second-guessed. The president of the police union in Minneapolis, there is a video of him at a rally for President Trump saying that the police unions stand behind President Trump because he took the handcuffs off of them that the Obama administration put on them.
I hear you. Kimberly, you're such an invigorating voice, but you're making me wonder, is this an insoluble problem? Is it a virus without a vaccine? Roxana Hay had an interesting piece in the Times the other day saying, you know, doctors, for sure, we absolutely know, and it's true, we'll find a coronavirus vaccine. But how long will we wait for a vaccine or a response to racism?
Well, one thing that I do think that is important, and this is just brass, you know, tacks politics, I think it's important to realize and not to underestimate the fact that there are possibilities of activating coalitions that actually did come together and produce a plurality of votes in the last election. It wasn't a winning majority because of, again, the history of slavery and shaping the Electoral College. But Hillary Clinton got more than 2 million votes more than her opponent. And I'm not going to say that all of those votes are necessarily, you know, racial justice votes, because they're not. But I am of the mind that we are really only looking, you know, I think for a single digit shift in many white voters to really change this trajectory. I think the first thing is we've got to come back from the brink right now. We're on the brink of slipping into an authoritarian state.
Thank you.
If nobody believed it before last night, that stunt that President Trump pulled, tear gassing innocent, peaceful protesters.
On the way to church, yeah.
March to the church and hold up a Bible. If people don't see that for what it is, that makes me weep.
Pick a favorite lesson from Reconstruction, but also from the second one. What are the choicest little examples of what we've got to learn and relearn now in a hurry?
Favorite lesson from the first Reconstruction was the amazing work that was done when black farmers and white farmers were able to come together and not allow their alliances to be shattered by the use of race and racism by the plantation owners, the owners of capital and industry, to create dissension among their ranks. The ability to work together to create schools, the ability to work together to see, however briefly, that what held them together was more important than the manipulated way that race was being used to give one group a sort of symbolic leg up on the other. That was an amazing moment, and it happened and it passed. And it passed in part because racism, I want to say, and whiteness was too volatile a tool to explode those possibilities. So frankly, we're in a period where Trump's base are not the ones that are really benefiting from his economic programs.
Right.
Trump's base are people who are going to be hurting in ways that pretty much everybody else is hurting. But yet at this point, they're not made to see it. When you say what's the possibility is being able to break through the fantasy that their whiteness is being served in a way that makes up for the material ways that their lives are not better off. So if we can redirect that anger that's sure going to come when it becomes clear how much this stimulus package is actually lining pockets of billionaires and millionaires much more than the ordinary people, if we can stop people from punching down and instead looking up, which in some periods of American history we were able to do for a short period of time, we can figure out how to come out of this moment, bringing just some people over to this line, I think we've opened up possibilities that we've not seen in a generation.
What's the chance that in the lives and hearts of the protesters and demonstrators today, we are looking at the third Reconstruction in process?
I think we're looking at the seeds of it, for sure. I'm a gardener, right? So I sprout things a lot. When the conditions are right, the seedlings actually turn into fully productive life. Mm. But there's some element in the mix in where I put them, the sun that they get, what they're able to metabolize that allows them to fully flourish. And others, they remain, you know, something that could have been. You can't look at people, you know, willing to take on, you know, vicious repression of their free speech rights and not know that there is something in this mix that can possibly turn into something bigger than it is right now.
The breadth of it, it's everywhere. It's brave. Big crowds, journalists too, staring down
police, horses.
Staring down police with loaded guns pointing at them.
Tear gas.
What if this is almost the definition of what a third Reconstruction, the way it would begin?
Well, it's certainly the way that earlier ones began, people staring down effectively the state, you know, reinforcing the racial order, people putting their lives on the line to challenge it. That's how it starts. If the question is this a possibility? Of course it's a possibility. Is it what many people are hoping for? I mean, I've lived my life waiting for the civil rights movement to happen again. I know that there are millions of us who would love nothing more but for this to be the start of it, would love nothing more for the happenstance of, you know, this COVID thing happening that, you know, lays bare the fractures in this society and the inequities to be followed up by the embodiment of it, you know, somebody leaning on someone's neck until their life ebbs out of them while someone else is just standing there keeping people at bay. I mean, I think there's a way in which the casual way in which that life was taken is a metaphor for what's happening in society more broadly, the casualness in which we're going back to work, knowing life is being taken.
Yeah.
It's made the rawness of the inequality legible, like in neon lights.
Yeah. Kimberly Crenshaw, it's a privilege to meet you, to listen to you, to hear you.
Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed our conversation.
Our show this week was produced by Connor Gillies and Adam Coleman, with help from Amber Bryan and Azan Reed. Look on our website and listen to Amber's and Azan's individual versions of what's happening at radioopensource.org. Please consider supporting Open Source if you can. The best way is on Patreon, subscribers get to hear producer Adam Coleman and his series of interviews on close reading in a time of social distance. This week, Gabriel Bump, author of the new novel Everywhere You Don't Belong, a story of growing up on the south side of Chicago in a country shaped by racism and police violence. Listen, you'll love it. Patreon.com/radio open source.
Hub
and Spoke. Audio Collective.